Hello and welcome to the Local Economic Development Podcast.
Hosted by Sean Cunningham
and Jörg Meyer-Starmer.
For other programs in this series, please take a look at www.ledcast.net.
Welcome to a new series of the LED Cast. Sean, do you perhaps just want to explain why we start with a new series now?
Yes, this series is going to be a more conceptual series, so we want to probe a little bit deeper than we were able to do in our first series. So we see the first series as being a basic series introducing many of the concepts, and in this series we will be probing a little bit deeper, but we do not want to make this academic or theoretical, although we will certainly think of this as being more conceptual than the previous series.
All right. And I think we should also mention that we have decided to actually run several series in parallel. And we will reorganize the LEDcast.net website to reflect that. So we will have this series that we're starting now where we look at concepts. And then we will have another series where we look at very practical matters, at the kind of challenges that LED facilitators are confronting very frequently, and we will discuss how to deal with that. And then there will be a third series where we will look at specific topics and specific cases, specific experiences around local economic development. So there's going to be these three concurrent series that we are going to produce in the course of the next weeks and months.
So Jörg, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, what I think we could talk about is this issue that you wanted to talk about for quite some time, which is clusters and cluster promotion.
So Jörg, where does this whole cluster thing come from?
Well, I recall that the whole discussion started with a book that came out in 1984, which looked at industrial development in Italy, actually, and found out that in Italy there was not only big business, big companies like the Fiats of this world, but a strong element in the industrial drive and the industrial growth of Italy was due to small and medium-sized companies that were co-located in a number of locations, a number of places in northern Italy. And those small businesses had become extremely competitive, and they had become very competitive, well, because they were interacting very intensely, because each company was building on the competencies of other companies. Each company was highly specialized, but also because there was strong competition at the local level. So that's how it started.
And then Michael Porter made it popular in his book On the Competitive Advantage of Nations, where he really lifted out clusters and looked at the competitiveness of clusters and the role of clusters in national competitiveness.
That's right, yeah. I mean, the book was a bit of a misnomer. It should have been called The Competitive Advantage of Clusters. But yes, that gave a strong drive to the whole discussion. And at the same time, also for people in the academic world, there was other literature coming out, for instance, a couple of studies by the International Labour Organization. And also, I think Hubert Schmitz wrote his first paper on clusters in 1989.
Okay, so since then, this thing has featured quite often in policies and increasingly in LED.
Right.
But what is a cluster?
Ah, that's a good question, especially because very often policy focuses at places where you wonder, how is that really a cluster? So maybe let's start with the Italian example. In Italy, you have towns where pretty much all the industry that you find in that town is in the same sector, and actually in a very specific niche of the same sector. So you go to Prato, which is a town very close to Florence, where you have tens of thousands of employees working in thousands of companies, and they are all working around woolen fabric. So if you have an expensive suit, the fabric for that suit in all likelihood has come from Prato. So they're only specializing in that. They don't sew anything. There's no assembly, no sewing happening there, no dyeing and stuff. There's only the manufacturing of the fabric. And you have dozens and dozens of places like that in northern Italy. And after that had been discovered in Italy, then people looked at other countries and said, hang on, we do have that very same phenomenon in very many countries. So you go to Spain and you find that actually the other very, very competitive ceramic tile industry is located in just one very small region around the city of Castellón in eastern Spain. Or you go to Germany and you find that most of the surgical instruments that are manufactured in Germany and that are actually manufactured in Europe come from just one city in a province called Baden-Württemberg. So when you look around, you find that this phenomenon of clusters happens in very many countries, and not only in old industrialized countries, but also very often in developing countries. So somebody counted that there's like 4,500 clusters in Indonesia.
Okay, so a cluster is not always a massive industrial complex. It could also be small, but still highly competitive.
Yeah, and that takes us to one of the criteria to say, well, does it make sense to use this category of a cluster to describe something? If you have 50 crafters living close to each other, doing pretty much the same thing and scrambling for survival, you wouldn't describe that as a cluster. I mean, analytically, it wouldn't make sense to describe that as a cluster. Whereas if you have, let's say, 24 highly competitive companies in software that are located very close to each other, that compete to some extent, but that also get some amount of collective action going, then you definitely would describe that as a cluster. But I think that one of the key points is that clusters are not defined by the number of companies involved.
Okay.
Right. So if you have five companies, it's not a cluster, period. But you can have 50 or 500 or 5,000, and it still may or may not be described properly as a cluster with the connotations that we these days give to a cluster.
So when we have concentrations of similar firms, then we still just have a concentration of firms and not a cluster. When would this concentration of firms become a cluster?
Well, what typically happens is that in such a location where you have very many companies doing very similar things, a couple of things start to happen. One of the first and most obvious things is that more people start businesses in that same sector because they work at some company for some time and then they wonder, hey, why don't I do this myself? Why don't I run my own business? And they start their own business. And starting that is actually quite easy because a specialized workforce is available locally. It's not difficult to find skilled workers. It's not difficult to find new or used machinery because providers are available locally. It's not difficult to find inputs because many salespeople of inputs are coming to that place anyway because there's so many customers there. And often it's even easier to find customers there because if you know that for a given product you go to, say, Castellón or, say, Sassuolo, which is this Italian place, then for a new company that starts there, it's much easier to identify those customers and to interact with customers.
Okay, so there's certainly a benefit of this concentration. Although these firms are often fiercely competing, they benefit mm-hmm. because customers can find them easily and suppliers can find them easily.
Yeah. Right. So that is something that has been described by a cluster researcher called Khaled Nadvi as the passive advantages of clusters.
Okay.
Nobody is actively promoting this. It's just happening due to market forces. People are spotting business opportunities and pursue those business opportunities.
And I guess that it's easy for somebody in one of those firms to start their own company because they get a feeling of what the market wants.
Yeah.
And they get a feeling what some of the suppliers are commenting. So very often the firms started in those clusters are actually started by people in those businesses themselves.
That's right, yeah. And it may be that people get out and start doing the very same thing. But you also often find that, say, you have somebody who is working in a medium-sized garment operation and finds that it's very difficult to find those labels. You know, mm-hmm. those labels that say that it's 80% cotton and 20% whatever and don't wash it too hot and that stuff. So they say, okay, if it's so difficult to find that stuff here locally at a good price, then why don't I go into this business and start producing this? There seems to be a business opportunity. And we've often found that new businesses and specialized producers and specialized service providers emerge in a cluster because local people who used to be employees somewhere spot the business opportunity and then go for it.
So, Jörg, do the people in a cluster know that they're in a cluster?
Well, that is a good question. They intuitively tend to know it. It's something that I found quite interesting in Italy to see that people very much define themselves now as working in clusters or what they call industrial districts. Something that probably not existed 20 years ago, but there has been this huge hype and this enormous amount of literature and conferences and stuff. And it has even been reflected in Italian legislation that there are industrial districts. So nowadays, people in industrial districts say, well, we are an industrial district. I recall that in many places where I came in as a consultant and said, well, so you are a cluster, people would say, huh? What are you talking about? Right. And also we've seen that in many countries they've come up with new terms to kind of describe what a cluster is, because the term cluster didn't really hit home with people inside clusters. But related to that, I think is the important fact that people know that they are inside a cluster, but they often don't quite like it because they obviously see the advantages, but there's also lots of disadvantages. I mean, it's not only that you have fierce competitors locally, literally across the road, but you also have intense copying and stuff, which business people in clusters very much like to complain about.
And you might lose your staff any moment because they just walk next yep. door when they want a new job.
Yeah, and your neighbor might just poach your stuff and, well, yeah.
Which might actually be beneficial for the society, but not so grand for the firm.
Yes, that's right.
So just now you mentioned that some clusters have passive advantages. Do they have other advantages? I mean, if there's passive advantages, I would assume there's then also active advantages.
Yeah. For instance, when you look at those Italian clusters, the first place I ever saw personally was this Prato cluster. And it was quite remarkable to find that they actually had created a specialized technical school, something like 1905 or so. That is more than 100 years ago, and it had been pretty much driven by the private sector in those days. And also, when we met with the people in the local business chamber, we got the strong impression that they take a very active role in terms of promoting the cluster, promoting interaction inside the cluster, running seminars on issues that are relevant for companies and in the cluster, and so on. So we've often seen that inside clusters you have business associations that are very active in terms of creating additional advantages for the cluster. And then also there's government that comes in to a certain extent and creates dedicated infrastructure or dedicated institutions that are meant to support the cluster.
So the active clusters, there's actually networking and cooperation going on between the members in the cluster.
That is what typically happens, though it's interesting to see that research has shown that vertical collaboration is much easier to get and much more frequent than horizontal collaboration. So vertical collaboration would be between companies along the value chain in a given cluster.
Okay.
In a given cluster, the guy who is doing the design of a fabric interacts closely with the guy who is doing the spinning of the thread, and the guy who is doing the dyeing of the thread, and the guy who is then doing the weaving of the fabric. So there is very intense interaction between those guys, whereas the weavers among themselves may or may not be keen to talk too much about business because they are obviously competitors.
Okay, and they're very envious of each other.
Yeah.
But over time also, what happens as far as what I've seen is that these firms that are all very similar, very often in clusters start specializing. So in a given cluster, you could have 200 firms doing a very similar thing, being the same link in a bigger value chain. And over time, some of them start specializing and investing in very specific equipment, and other guys go the other way.
Yeah, right.
So in the cluster, over time, there is also increased specialization.
Yes.
And then these guys might actually be more willing to work with each other. But when they're all competing for exactly the same business, they're probably not so keen to cooperate.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe let's shift a little bit to the policy focus, why it is that policymakers are so keen on cluster promotion. I mean, you've seen that in your country. Why is it that this whole thing about clusters came up as a prominent issue?
Well, I do think that many policymakers approach clusters from a perspective that it appears to be easy to create jobs in clusters. Mm-hmm. So this physical co-location of firms that are similar or that use similar raw materials or that serve similar markets, for policymakers, it would then appear that by addressing these firms as a collective, that they could maybe get them to upgrade or employ more people.
Mm-hmm.
I do also think that it's a very visible approach.
Yeah.
You know, where dealing with the retailers is never very popular.
Yeah.
But by taking a certain concentration of firms, it's easier to identify the firms. So it's actually one of those passive benefits of clusters.
Yeah.
But it's also visible for policymakers. It actually shows that they are doing something.
Mm.
I also think there's another thing that I've seen often, and that is that cluster approaches tend to be driven by industrial estate development.
Uh-huh.
So the first intervention that policymakers very often want to do is they actually want to flatten a piece of land and put up buildings and then try and build a cluster.
Build a cluster. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Sorry. Right. Okay. And then what?
Is that how you're going to respond now? Or do we have to redo that?
No. Let's keep it like that.
And your response.
Well, I think it's important to realize that there's cluster promotion approaches that work and that have worked, and there's cluster promotion approaches that don't work and have never really worked. The only example that I'm aware of where a government intervention has literally created a cluster is a major industrial park in Taiwan. There is something called the Hsinchu Industrial Development Zone or something, which was organized since the late 1970s and in the 80s around information technology. And they ultimately succeeded in creating an electronics and information technology cluster in that location. And they pretty much did that from, well, not exactly from scratch, but with very few initial assets. So that is the one example that I'm aware of. I think these approaches that you just mentioned, where people effectively create an industrial estate and try to design that and try to coin that as a cluster promotion approach, that usually doesn't work. All the cluster promotion approaches that have been successful were activities where some kind of cluster had already emerged through market forces. And then policymakers came in and, sped that up and amplified it and came up with specialized organizations that looked at skills or specialized metrology necessities or specialized research and development activities or simply other types of dedicated infrastructure.
Yes, I do think also that what I've seen very often is that a cluster could be spread over, say, a small town. And then very often a government policy approach would be to try and get all these people to co-locate,
yeah,
or to get 50 new firms to start up in one building.
Mm.
You know, and where cluster people are very well connected, they do not like being pushed, you know, into the same space necessarily. Mm.
Yeah.
Although there's other cases where these kind of industrial estates have emerged naturally, simply because of the concentration in a cluster.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you look at how cluster promotion worked in places where you already had dozens, if not hundreds, of companies, and especially in those places where it happened quite naturally, you often find that they are producing initially under rather precarious conditions. Within residential areas or even within their private homes. And for such businesses, being able to relocate into a proper industrial estate is a big win and something that they definitely appreciate.
Maybe just another point about, you know, policymakers, why they are excited about clusters. The smart policymakers are also excited about clusters because it is an approach where they can make very small inputs into a system that is already working,
mm-hmm,
in order to improve the performance of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, so we do know that there are places where policymakers look at a cluster and they see, well, there is something here that is missing.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't take that much effort to organize or to respond to that.
Yeah. So typical examples would be
an off-ramp off a highway to connect a cluster to the transport network,
yeah,
easier.
Yeah. Or I recall the ILO produced this, UNIDO produced this video about their cluster development activities in India, where in one place a dry port proved to be a very, very important infrastructure element.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not small. It still took a lot of resources to do that.
Yeah.
But in terms of trying to design a new cluster or trying to completely overhaul a cluster, that is certainly a very specific
intervention. Also skills development at a secondary level or at higher education level is often something that makes a lot of sense in a cluster setting, and is something that the private sector very often will not do. So government has to come in with that.
But what you've just mentioned actually leads us very nicely into the next section, where we can look at what are some of the practical things that practitioners and policymakers can do to make clusters work better. And maybe the first thing is that to start off by trying to connect the different actors, but then realizing at the same time that you cannot push very similar firms to cooperate much unless there's a lot of benefit in them cooperating, if there's a big obstacle that they have to overcome.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the basic economic principle is that if the benefits of cooperation outweigh the costs of participation or the threats of participation, then people would be more likely to cooperate.
Yes, that's the theory. From the practical perspective of a business, it looks quite different. What a business person typically will think is that the collaboration has an immediate risk. It has the risk right here and now, and it has a cost right here and now. The risk is that I happen to mention some business secrets that I don't really want to talk about, but then it just slips out and all my competitors know what I'm going to do next, and shame. Or it is the cost, the simple opportunity cost of spending a lot of time in workshops or something like that, whereas the benefit will only come later. So there's immediate cost and risk versus a long-term benefit. And that is one reason why business people are often not very excited about this collaboration idea. And also, if you experience the other local companies not only as competitors, but to some extent as predators who are snatching customers away from you by offering them deals that are not really sustainable, then you start to wonder whether you really want to talk to that guy ever again.
Okay. At the same time, we have to bear in mind the work done. You know, I'm thinking of this Just Clusters publication, which is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. That also, to me, just highlighted that clusters are really also social networks. They're not purely just...
Yeah.
It's not just business people, hard-nosed business people, but there's a lot of social interaction going on, a lot of joint speculating and brainstorming and dreaming going on. You know, people are employed because they know somebody more than because they have exactly the right skills.
Yeah.
There's a lot of social aspects to clusters that typically do not get attention in cluster approaches.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I often rather get the impression that people are too much preoccupied with the hugging and kissing approach inside clusters, and take the fact that those guys do play golf or do play tennis or meet at the Lions Club or whatever as an indication that they also talk about business, which is not necessarily the case. And my experience has been that clusters are extremely path-dependent in that respect. If you have a small number of very complicated, extremely competitive and unethical characters in a given cluster, they can create an atmosphere inside the cluster where nobody trusts nobody. And that is extremely path-dependent. It's so difficult to change that. And vice versa, if in a given place, in a given cluster, you have at a certain stage very cooperative characters, very, well, community-minded characters, they can create an atmosphere that very much encourages and stimulates collective action inside that cluster. And that also is highly path-dependent.
You know, what I tried to bring across with my point was that what I've often seen in cluster approaches is that consultants draw up a map of the cluster as it is now, or a map of how the cluster could operate.
Yeah.
And then they try to fix the map, and then they try to take what they see the potential of this map, and they try to rearrange or reconnect the actors in the cluster without realizing that there are these social networks, whether they are always positive networks and whether all the links are always healthy and ethical is another debate. But they ignore the fact that the cluster is also constructed that way because it benefits the actors in the cluster, or, you know, somebody somewhere is benefiting from the clumsy map. You know, so one must be careful not to just analyze the cluster and say, oh my goodness, but these guys aren't connected to those. Let's connect them.
Yeah, yeah.
That is not necessarily going to take you to the next level of performance.
Yeah, yeah. This other theory that I have, which is based on a couple of observations that I made, is that if you want to start organizing collective action in a cluster where business people don't really trust each other, you better start with activities that bring you immediate gains, immediate benefits, and that don't really touch on core activities of companies.
Yes.
So organizing collective action around, say, basic skills of employees is an obvious option. Or some clusters have been quite successful in organizing collective action around environmental issues, whereas organizing collective action around technology is something that is hugely complicated, or collective purchasing or collective sales. Businesses just don't trust each other when it comes to that, and you only can do that when you have a very mature and robust pattern of interaction.
Yeah, so if a practitioner becomes involved with a cluster, it is not ideal to start pushing for overall technical upgrade and efficiency upgrades all round, but to look at the points that are not threatening to any of the stakeholders and to maybe start there.
Yeah, exactly.
Jörg, when is cluster promotion inappropriate?
Well, there's, I think, two scenarios that I've seen quite often where it's inappropriate. Apart from the one that we just mentioned, where you have just nothing and try to create an industrial estate and sell that as a cluster initiative. The one case that we've seen quite often is wishful thinking clusters, where you actually do have a couple of companies in a given sector, and you could actually think that it would be useful if they interacted and if they engage in some joint learning activities or something. But it's just too few. It's just too little. It's unlikely that you will ever create this very diverse structure of highly specialized companies and specialized subcontractors and specialized service providers and specialized organizations in that case. So I think that is a situation where cluster promotion is, well, not exactly the right approach, and you would rather think about, well, why not talk about business networking activities or something like that. The other kind of constellation is something that I briefly mentioned earlier, that kind of place that we've so often seen in many developing countries, where you have dozens, if not hundreds, of crafters or small businesses doing very much the same thing, but not really having very high skills and not really having sophisticated products, not having any pattern of specialization among them, and really doing standard products and competing purely on price. And whenever there is a downturn in the market, everybody takes down the prices, pushes down the prices, and tries to undercut their neighbors. And that is a kind of setting where cluster initiatives are just extremely unlikely to work, not only because nobody trusts nobody else, but also because the potential in terms of skills, in terms of technological sophistication, organizational sophistication, management skills, and so on, is just not there and cannot be built in any meaningful period of time.
And then maybe there's a third one, and that would be constellations that are there. They've been there for a long time. I'm thinking of a specific place where there's quite a number of furniture manufacturers. They've been there for 20 years. They'll probably be there for another 20 years, but they would never become a cluster. They're fiercely competing for inputs.
Yeah.
They're not even serving the same markets. They're not using similar techniques or technologies.
Right.
So the fact that they are all somehow doing something with wood doesn't actually make them, you know, connected enough for them to really want to benefit from working closer together. So that's maybe just another version of wishful thinking clusters.
Yeah, it's a local sector, but it's not a cluster.
Yes, okay.
Okay, maybe let us leave it at that for now. What we're going to indicate at the website is some references. You mentioned the Just Clusters study, which is really great. There's also a paper that we have written some time ago where we try to outline how to do cluster promotion. So anybody who wants to get a deeper understanding could have a look at that. And then with this new series, we wanted to come up with a different way of wrapping up our show.
I think that for this show today, Jörg, it's very important that we get some feedback or comments from our listeners mm-hmm. on whether our shows are too long or whether they're too short, whether we should...
Or too shallow or too deep.
Yes, whether we should dig deeper or whether we should back out a little bit.
Okay.
And so we want to invite you to contact us. You can email us at the following address, contact@ledcast.net, or you can go onto the website and click on comments.
Right.
And if we use any terms or any concepts that you are not familiar with or that you have a very different interpretation of, then please contact us because we can then clarify that in a future show.
Okay. So please do give us your feedback. Please go to www.ledcast.net. And we changed the design a little bit, so it's now much easier to locate the place where we want you to leave the comments. So please do.